Hello.
Hi.
Fred, thank you very much for your donation, UNSEM. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. We're very grateful to be able to help out.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, Betsy.
Hello.
Are we doing today? How are you feeling from your dental work?
Was shockingly nothing. I couldn't believe it. I had a wisdom tooth out yesterday, Fred.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was more scared. That took more of it than anything.
Well, and with Seema, there's she has some work that was delayed, and so
I'm going to mute everybody, and if you need to speak, you can raise your hand. But when I'm done, we can have a conversation afterwards if anyone has any comments or thoughts. Okay. Here we go.
God,
Okay.
listen to Rabbi
Let
Zach.
everybody on mute. Hold on. Okay. All right. So my opening has to do with a thought about the fact that in this week's Parsha, we're told about counting. You shall count for yourself, 7 weeks, 50 days, and then you will bring the Omer offering, right? It's how we determine the time between, well, the Torah never says it. We know that we count 49 days. On the 50th day, an Omer barley offering was brought. And what we also know is that's when we celebrate Shavuot, right? Matan Torah, the revelation at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, the giving of the Torah. Okay. What was interesting was I saw from an older rabbi back when I was youth director in Teaneck, New Jersey, in the early 80s. It was a rabbi, Victor Solomon. He was kind of a lay rabbi. He wasn't practicing in the rabbinate, but I think he was in business, but he used to write a lot of Divrei Torah. One of the things he comments on is the interesting how the Torah sees counting. In other words, in most societies, we talk about counting. What is one counting?
Days.
Well, generally we talk about counting, right? We talk about counting things, right? We count
Okay, all right.
money, we count possessions. He says that's Sfirat HaChomer. Right? Chomer being material, right? Sfirat HaChomer, most society is what they value. I shouldn't say people count days, but what people value is Sfirat HaChomer. They value what they possess, their material possessions. We are Sfirat HaOmer. What do we count? We count up to the bringing of an offering, right? An offering is something that we give, we sacrifice, we give up a possession. When we bring an offering, we give up a possession in service of God. And even more so when we think about the Omer's being on Shavuot, on the day in which we receive the Torah, that we count, we value the spiritual over the material. That's my introductory thought. Now to get to today's topic. Today's topic, I wanted to begin by addressing. There is a philosophic endeavor that takes place in Judaism called Tamei HaMitzvot. What is Tamei HaMitzvot? Anyone? Oh, you can't answer. Tamei HaMitzvot,
Explaining the
Tamei HaMitzvot
myth.
is, as we
Explaining
usually look at it, is trying to derive the reasons for the commandments. Now, when we talk about the reasons for the commandments, what that means is that clearly God has a reason, or God had a reason for giving up each one of the commandments. Some of those reasons we can fathom. Some of those reasons we can fathom even if God didn't command them. Many of them will never be able to fathom what the reason is. Whether we can fathom a reason or not is really not so relevant because it doesn't change our obligation to observe the commandment. However, there is both reason for the commandments and then there is purpose. When we talk about Tamei, what is, when we talk about Tamei HaMitzvot, understanding the mitzvot, what is the purpose for me for a particular mitzvah. That we can and should be able to come to some kind of understanding as to what is the purpose of this mitzvah. If this mitzvah, if God commanded me to do something that ultimately is supposed to be part of creating the self-actualized, fully actualized individual or society, then I ought to be able to figure that out. And so the question that I want to address today is, what on some level for us today is the purpose of the kahuna, of the priesthood, right? This morning's, this week's parsha of Emor, the first half of it deals with the priesthood, the kahuna, the kohanim, things they can do, things they can't do. So if I were to ask you, because in this week's parsha in particular, it deals with the sanctity of the kahuna. But if I were to ask you, what is the purpose of the kahuna? What is the reason, not the reason, the purpose of the kahuna? So I would come up with probably two or three understandings. One is, and the primary one was, doesn't exist today, was to minister in the Beit HaMikdash. Correct? They ministered, they did the avodah, the service in the Beit HaMikdash. We don't have the Beit HaMikdash today. So the avodah of the kahuna is not relevant. In fact, the avodah, the service of the kahuna in the temple, right, of bringing korbanot, has now shifted to where?
Prayer.
Has now shifted to the synagogue, to tefillah, to prayer, that we do, not the kohen. We do the tefillah, the avodah, each and every day. We don't rely on the kahuna to do it for us. However, we can fathom some other goals of the kohen. So what I'm going to, if I can, share my screen. Okay. So now what I want to share with you is source number 2, 3, and 4. In the prophet Yechezkel says regarding the Kohanim, V'etami yoru ben kodesh l'chol ben tamei l'tohar yod'u. They, the Kohanim, shall declare to my people what is sacred and what is profane, and inform them what is clean and what is unclean. In Malachi it says, Kisifte kohen yishmeru dat v'torah yivakshumi dat v'torah yivakshumi pihu ki malach adonai tzibotu. For the lips of the kohen guard knowledge, and men seek rulings from his mouth, for he is a messenger of the Lord of hosts. And finally, in Dvarim itself, in Moshe's final oration, Yoru mishpatecha liyakov v'toratcha liyisrael yasumu keturah. They, the Kohanim, shall teach your laws to Jacob and your instructions to Israel. They shall offer you incense to savor and whole offerings on your altar. So if I were to say, what is the relevance of the Kohanim today and back then, the other main goal of the role of the Kohen was to teach Torah. They were the teachers. They were the ones who spent their time engaged in Yorut, not just teaching, but directing in terms of halacha to the congregation, to the community. So the other things that also was one of the other major roles of the Kohen, which was primarily outside of Israel. We only experience it today, but it's something that we do experience today. In Israel, they experience it each and every day. Outside of Israel, we only experience it on Yom Tov. That is Birchat Kohanim, right? The blessings of the Kohanim. The Kohanim's ability to bless us, to give us blessing. So how does that fit in? So I want to share with you ultimately a thought of Rav Kook. Before we get there, I want to understand how the Kohanim and what they are able to do today, how that informs who we are and what we can be, what our purpose is as well. So with that, there's an interesting question that Rav Kook raises. And the question that he raises is that every day we recite Birchat HaTorah, right? The Birchat HaTorah is the blessings that we say. Well, let's go back. Studying Torah is a mitzvah. So the question is, do we make a bracha on that mitzvah? The answer is yes. We do every morning in Birchat HaTorah, and the primary bracha is, the primary bracha is source number 5. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Ha'amim Benatan Lanu Et Torato. Baruch Ata Hashem Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has chosen us from all of the nations and given us his Torah. Blessed are you, Lord, gives Torah. Now, two things about this bracha. It uses the phrase, it doesn't say, in the end it says, who gave us the Torah, but at first it says, our obligation and fulfilling the mitzvah of studying Torah is a bechira. What's a bechira? A bechira is a birthright. We were chosen. Bechira means a birthright. That God chose us, right, to be his nation, and he gave us the Torah, and therefore, bless a God who gives us the Torah. Now, if we make a bracha, on studying Torah, when you make a bracha, the bracha, generally, if I make a bracha over the lulav or etrog, or lighting Shabbat candles, do I make the bracha and then go eat breakfast? Do I make the bracha and then go to work? When I make the bracha, it has to be over l'asiyatan. I have to make the bracha over the mitzvah itself. So in the early part, in the Birchat HaTorah, immediately after saying Asher Bachar Banu, we immediately recite words of Torah. In fact, if you look in the Siddur, we recite a section from the five books of Moshe, from the Torah. We recite from the Mishnah, and we recite from the Gemara. Right there, that section. But the first section we do is a few passages, a few sentences of Torah. Everyone know what is it that we recite? So it could be, we could recite, why don't we recite Shema Yisrael? Right, Hear, O Israel, Lord is our God. Why don't we recite the Ten Commandments? Why don't we recite passages from the Exodus from Egypt? What is the passage that we recite? The passage that we recite is Birchat Kohanim.
Right.
Verse number 6, right? So the question is asked, why is Birchat Kohanim what we recite when we say, after reciting the blessing on the Torah. So what's coming together is our obligation to study Torah and the blessing of the Kohanim. Why are these the two things that are connected one to the other? So the Abu Dharam, his answer is the rabbis wanted to kind of learn something else out from it. He says, if you look at the verses here, Yivarecha Hashem v'yishmerecha, the first verse has 3 words, then Ya'er has 5 words, and Yisa has 7 words. So Abu Ram says, that's to teach us, you know what, 3, because we have 3 aliyot during the week when we lane. On Yom Tov, we have 5 aliyot, and on Shabbat, we have 7 aliyot. Therefore, they chose that passage because mnemonically, we can learn something else from it. So Rav Kook has a much, much deeper understanding and interpretation. And he says as follows. The first thing he says is, you know, we're far removed from the kahuna of Aharon, right? Aharon and his sons, who were biblically chosen to be the first Kohanim, those are the only Kohanim that we know by name that were basically designated as Kohanim, right? They were literally lifted up in wave. Well, they were lifted up in wave. They were anointed to the kahuna. But now we're many, many millennia away from that. What gives the Kohanim of today their rights and responsibilities? By the way, amongst the responsibilities I didn't mention that the Kohanim observe today, aside from giving Birchat Kohanim, is they also observe the the right of not making themselves tamei, not coming in contact with the dead, except for those that they're allowed for, their immediate family members, and for not marrying, right, a divorcee or a convert. Okay, so he says as follows. He says that every kohen has a segula klalit haba'a beYerusha, a segula, a virtue that is bequeathed by heredity. In other words, every kohen by birth has certain rights and virtues that are descended down to them by virtue of the fact that they are direct descendants of Aharon and his children. And through that innate internal Yerusha, he says, they have, therefore, this virtue includes a responsibility for Hora'ah, for teaching, based on the verses that we taught. One of the things that is an innate responsibility and virtue of the kuhuna is the responsibility to teach, right? In addition to performing the rites of the Kohanim to bless Klal Yisrael. Now, one of the things that Rav Kook says is when the Kohen blesses the people, right? He has a particular posture. What's the posture of the Kohen? He stands and he has to do what with his hands?
Spread his middle fingers.
He raises his hands above his head. And right. If you raise your hand and you make the sign of the Kohen, right? It's almost like an arrow. If you think about it, the position of the Kohen is like an arrow. Where is the arrow pointing?
Shemayim to Hashem.
It's pointing outward and upward. So it's pointing really in three directions, you could say. It's pointing up to Hashem. It's pointing out to the congregation. And it's pointing upward and outward towards the future. In other words, the blessing of the Kohen is on a certain level aspirational. Now it's aspirational on two levels. On one level, it's aspirational for the Kohen himself. In other words, do you have to be a Kohen Talmud Chacham in order to do Birkat Kohanim? Do you have to be a knowledgeable Talmud Chacham of a Kohen because part of your thought is to be able to do Birkat Kohanim? The answer is no. But by raising his hands, one aspect of that is an aspirational aspect for the Kohen to understand that embedded within himself is that potential and that responsibility to teach, to project, to outwardly lead. Now, Rav Kook goes one step further. And he learns this, again, he learns this from the juxtaposition now of the Birchat HaTorah with the blessing of the Kohanim that we do every morning. Why are those two particularly connected? Because the aspirational responsibility of the Kohen is paralleled and is pointing out to the congregation that there is an opposite or complementary responsibility and virtue of Klal Yisrael. So in other words, just like the Kohen has a segula klalit, a communal virtue that comes by virtue of his heredity, right? By virtue of his genealogy, the same is true of the rest of Bnei Yisrael. That Bnei Yisrael has a segula, not klalit, although that's a different idea that we have, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, but a segula kibalit, Hababa Yerusha, that we have a virtue to receive Torah, that is an inherent value, to receive the Torah and its instruction. So in other words, there's a connection to the Kohen doing the blessing. It's an outward responsibility by genealogy of the Kohen to disseminate and to be blessed and to bless us through the Torah. But we have a commensurate responsibility by virtue of our genealogy to be able to receive the Torah and its instruction. So therefore, in other words, as I write here, Jewish learning and Jewish instruction is not something that is imposed upon us. We think at Har Sinai it was imposed upon us. Rather, it is a natural virtue that pre-exists in the Jewish soul, right? Vatemti, what did it say right before we received the Ten Commandments on Har Sinai? Vatemti uli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You shall be to me by virtue of b'chira, asher bochar banu. I chose you. Asher bochar banu mikol ha'amim. I chose you from all of the nations. Natan lanu Torah to. He gave us his Torah that we should be what? A kingdom of kohanim. Mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, a holy people, not as kohanim, but as the receivers of that Torah. And therefore, every Jew has embedded within themselves, we have embedded within ourselves the natural receptors for Torah, just as the Kohen has certain receptors to minister in temple times and to teach and to bless. It's part of our DNA, our spiritual DNA, if you will. And that's why the liturgy juxtaposes the blessing of studying the Torah with the text of Birkat Kohanim. Both are aspirational sense of fulfilling our inherited potential. So in other words, at the moment that we make a bracha that says we were chosen by God and given his Torah, blessed is God, give us the Torah. Well, now what's the aspiration? Aspiration now is we have to go learn the Torah, we have to study the Torah. And immediately, how do we know that? How do we know that we are able to? I don't have the innate ability. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody can't acquire that from without. We have Geirei Tzedek, we have righteous converts, who some say had the neshama to begin with, right? But we have the innate receptors. And the proof is, Yivarecha Hashem v'yishmarecha. Right away, we get the priestly blessings, the Birkat Kohanim, and the vision of the Kohanim lifting up their hands out toward us, right? For receptor to receptor, right? That this is the idea that the Kohen as teacher and B'nai Yisrael as Mamlechet Kohanim comes together when we study the Torah. So therefore, the Birkat HaTorah Shebarcha Banu and the priestly blessings, the responsibility of the Kohen to share that comes together. And that is the purpose today, one of the purpose and goals of the Kohen in doing Birchat Kohanim is to make that connection, to make sure that we get the link between the dissemination and the reception of Torah. That's my thought for today. If anybody wants a copy of the source sheet, I'm happy to send it to you. Anybody has any comments, I'm unmuting you all. You can all speak if you like. Well, you have to unmute yourselves, I guess.
I'll take a copy.
Okay. I'll have Francis send it out a little later.
Okay.
Do you think that the Kohanim, did they, in order to be a Kohen, were there any qualifications that would annul your Kohenism?
Yes, for example, if you married one of the people you're not allowed to marry, then what happens is not you, but your children are no longer considered Kohanim, and generally the rights of the Kohuna are not extended to that person.
Okay, so what happens to the lineage then? Is it
done? It no longer becomes a Kohanitic.
It's annulled, right? Okay. So you really don't know when we do the Birchat Kohanim on our high holiday services, that the people that are doing it, it seems like it's more customary than earned, because I don't know how righteous the people are that are blessing the congregation.
Correct. So we don't check for that. What we basically say is what we call a cheskat hakashrut. There is a presumption of that they are who they say they are, who they told they were are, either by their parents or grandparents.
Right.
And unless there's a reason to investigate, we don't question that.
Right. Okay. Do you have an opinion of whether what you just talked about today and Tikkun Olam have a connection? The reason I say this, I was listening to a Chabad lecture, and somebody has their mic on that's creating a lot of background noise. I don't know who it is, but it's hard. The Rabbi Teldin was talking about Tikkun Olam actually being, and this is for Jews and non-Jews alike, that the goal is to achieve holiness, to make the world holy by our actions. And by doing that, we allow a place that Hashem can come down and reveal his majesty. Do you agree with that view of Tikkun Olam, or do you think you have a, because it has to do with the Kadoshim?
So, I do have a little bit of an issue on the right and on the, two different opinions of Tikkun Olam. There's one opinion which you, the Kabbalistic opinion of Tikkun really means to repair. And if you know the Kabbalistic idea of the shattering of the vessels, and therefore on some metaphysical level, we have to put together the metaphysical parts of the world that were broken when God created the world, when God limited himself to allow for the creation of the world. And if we fix those vessels, how do we fix those vessels? Well, we follow the Torah, we do the mitzvot, and then if everybody does it, right, we fix it. And then by fixing it, you know, God can come down into this world. Mm-hmm. That's the Kabbalistic.
Yeah,
on the other side is the more progressive approach, where Tikkun Olam has become basically a sense of more of an ethical monotheism, where basically our religion teaches us to be ethical human beings, and therefore if we follow a certain system of ethics, whether we have to follow the ritual or not is a different issue, we repair the world by doing social justice, so to speak. That's on the other extreme. I am not a subscriber. Both of those have extreme value, and both of those are things that we should be doing for both of those reasons. But that's not our approach. I would say the more centrist approach, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was a big arbiter of this, is that every moment of every day has the potential for kedusha, has the potential for holiness, that every action we do, we are able to suck the holiness out of our physical surroundings. And some of that, and therefore every moment that I can bring God into this world, or by utilizing something that God has given us in the physical world in service of each other or in service of God, ipso facto reaches up and brings holiness into this world each and every day. And that's why the halakha addresses every aspect of our life. When I'm at work, what I eat, what I do, how I tie my shoes, the Torah tells me, the halakha tells me. Well, it seems ridiculous. All this minutia, what is it, Shabbat, with all its rules, what is that all about? Is that every moment is a potentially holy moment. And therefore, it's instructive to know that, to be aware, right? When we make a blessing over our food, we're acknowledging God's presence and providing us with the raw materials from which we are able to eat and sustain ourselves. Mm-hmm. I could go on and on. I don't want to go too deep into it. So it's not about, you know, God isn't going to show up. You know, we want Mashiach now, because until we get Mashiach, God isn't going to show up in this world. So let's just bring it now. Let's repair the world, and then God can come. And so the problem is that's too much of a delayed gratification for my liking, for having be able to commune with God. On the one hand, I can commune with God every moment, every second of every day. Mm-hmm. If I understand the idea of how I can bring holiness into the world. Part of that is, of course, through social justice. Absolutely. How we, v'yavta re'echa kamocha, kol yisrael ha'rovim zeh bazeh, we have all kinds of obligations to each other, and those are holy moments also. But it isn't just about that. That's not the only way that we repair the world, or quote unquote, bring God into this world. It's through our religious mindfulness as well. It's also, by the way, of our elevating. I mentioned this last class, right? We elevate the physical when we take grapes, when we make wine, when we make kiddush, and we drink it in moderation, and we enjoy a Shabbat or a Yom Tov meal together. That's as spiritually uplifting and as much as bringing kedusha into this world as doing a kindness for another person. So
that's why when you were talking the other day, I guess it was Monday, I asked you specifically what being holy meant.
So
and now it's coming around to your discussion today. So it's important. So it fed into your discussion today.
So,
but you were talking about humility, being right. Humble.
Correct. So, because honestly, and Steve, thank you for bringing us, it's not about being holy. It's about bringing holiness. When it says kadoshim to you, you shall be holy, doesn't mean this. It means be a person who brings holiness okay. into the world.
That's a big difference. Thank you. I think that really explains it a lot better, because in my mind, I say a human can never achieve holiness by the fact that we're human. We can't be holy. I mean, unless God makes us holy, like the Kohanes or Moshe or whoever it is. But I had trouble with, but what you say now makes more sense.
Okay. Now, remember, having said that, we all have a spark of holiness within us because we all have a neshama. And the neshama is a little bit of the essence of God, so to speak, the pintle yid, we call it, right? That spark. So we have a certain holiness within us. So I don't want to totally say we're not holy, or we don't have to be holy. But when it says be holy, like I, the Lord your God, am holy, like it said right. last week's parsha, right. means do things that bring holiness, like God did by creating the world and the physical world. Engage the world. Engage the world not to exploit it. Getting back to my first comment about Sfirat HaChomer versus Sfirat HaOmer, right? Don't exploit the world. Utilize the world. That was the big misconception in the Garden of Eden. When God said, have dominion, kivshua, conquer the world, God didn't mean exploit the world, that you're the master of the universe, right? Or master of the house, as they said in Les Mis. Right? But that you have the ability to utilize everything in the physical world in the service of holiness. To me, that's the middle ground between the two ideas of Tikkun Olam.
One more question that I have for you. Do you think, in your opinion, is the Torah living or is it immutable? In other words, can you extrapolate from Torah readings and make changes in interpretations based on the contemporary times? And let me tell you why this question occurred. In the Parsha of this last week, it was talking about rounding the things that you can't do. And we're not supposed to round off our hair, you know?
Right.
Okay, so I said, well, I believe that they didn't want it rounded off back then because it showed you may be an idolater or an Egyptian, and you don't want to look like the Egyptians. But that's right. Not the case anymore. An Egyptian can look just like us. So either the theory of what I'm saying is not correct, that it has nothing to do with looking like an Egyptian, or if it is, then why can't we change it in the 21st century and say we don't need to do that anymore because we don't have to worry about it.
That's a great question. Thank you, Steve. So two parts to that question. One is it goes back to my very opening of my opening of this last part that we just did, which is the idea of tamei hamitzvot, of giving reasons for the commandments. There's grave danger in giving reasons to the commandments, as well as great comfort in having knowing the reasons for the mitzvot. Now, there's only a few cases, and I'll share this with you. We have a few minutes. What's the danger of tamei mitzvot? The danger of tamei mitzvot is if you tell me this is the reason, I say, oh, great. That doesn't apply anymore. Now I don't have to observe this mitzvah anymore. I'll give you an example. The early reformers, in dealing with the idea of kashrut, dealing with the idea of not being able to eat pork, said, you know why the Torah gave us all the kashrut laws? Was for health and safety. Basically, the Torah was the USDA of its time, right? And you know what? Pork, prior to having proper refrigeration, you could get trichinosis very easily from pork. But you know what? Today, we have refrigeration. We have an ice box. Mm-hmm. Now we have a refrigerator. Therefore, we don't have to worry about trichinosis. Therefore, we can eat pork. Well, the Torah didn't tell us that's the reason we can't eat pork. We told us that it didn't have the signs to be a kosher animal. It's considered a trefa, mm-hmm. a tame animal. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I can rationalize it doesn't give me the right to change the law. By the way, proof of this is there's only really one or two areas where the Torah gives us tamei mitzvot. One of them has to do, ironically, with the kings. When it talks about having a king, it says that a king of Israel, cannot have too many wives, and the king of Israel cannot have too many horses. And then the Torah says why. It says you shouldn't have too many wives, because too many wives will sway your heart and you'll end up becoming an idolater. Too many wives will turn your heart and your soul away from God.
That's not Torah though, right?
Huh?
That's not Torah, that's Talmud?
No, it's in the Torah. It's in the Torah.
Okay.
Well, look it up in Parshat, after Kitavo. Why am I blanking on the Parsha's name? And then it says you shouldn't have too many horses because you'll go back to Egypt, because the best horses, as I mentioned, are in Egypt. You'll go back to Egypt, where I told you you'll never return to. Wait a minute. So now that's the Torah gives us the reason in black and white. Too many wives will sway your heart from Hashem. Too many horses, you'll go back to Egypt. Now, of all the kings, who was the wisest?
David?
King Solomon. King Solomon. And you know what? Solomon had way more wives than Torah permitted. And he had way more horses. The stables of Solomon were well known. And guess what? Solomon at one point engaged in idolatry because of one of his wives swayed his heart in idolatry. And he went back to Egypt to get horses. Because Solomon said, I know the reason, and I'm the wisest guy around. And since I know the reason, I'll be very careful about that, and I won't transgress the reason, right? Because I'm so smart. Didn't work. He failed. So when we talk about tamei mitzvah, giving reasons for the mitzvah, we have to be very careful, because once we think we know the reason, aha, I know the reason, I'm not obligated anymore. I don't have to worry. The reason is no longer a concern. Therefore, knowing the reason, I don't have to do it. Much better spend time like we did today, figure out the purpose rather than the reason. Now, having said that, since we don't really know the reasons, we can't just, get rid of any, the Torah is immutable, and the Torah is living. How do I mean? That we have several places where the Torah says, it says, lo tatiro, you can't add to it, you can't take away from it. At the same time, the Torah is adaptable. By the way, one of the tests of a false prophet, right? Another one of the parashiyot is, if a prophet comes and he can prove he's a prophet, he can do miracles, whatever it is, he can do, perform what quote unquote miracles, we say, oh, he must be a prophet. If he tells us that we don't have to keep Shabbat anymore, he's not a prophet.
Not a prophet.
Okay. Likewise, however, the Torah is adaptable. The Torah is able to figure out, for example, my best example of this is always when microwaves first came out. The question was, can I microwave on Shabbat? In other words, if I put a chicken in a microwave and set a timer to turn on the microwave, if I could do that, right, and cook my chicken, like I leave for shul on Friday, on Shabbos morning, the microwave goes on, I come home and I got a nice cooked chicken, is that okay? And the reason they asked the question was because cooking, according to the Torah's definition of cooking, according to the rabbi's understanding, is by using a heat source. So it could be the sun, right? It could be using the sun, using a flame, so using coals, but it had to be a heat source. The truth is microwaves don't work that way. How do microwaves work? They excite the molecules, the water molecules inside of food, right? And the excitement of those molecules create energy that cooks the food, that ultimately creates heat, but it's not an external heat source, it's an internal source based on the exciting of the molecules, correct? So people wanted to know, is it considered cooking? Right. It's not considered cooking, I can do it on Shabbat. So Rav Moshe Feinstein basically said, it's not what the rabbis meant. In other words, if they would have had microwaves or solar ovens in the desert, they would have cooked by solar oven or by microwaves. In other words, their definition of cooking is taking a piece of food in its raw state and converting it into an edible state through the manipulation of, you know, of heat, but it doesn't have to necessarily be external heat, even internal heat. And that was a tshuva. So when I say the Torah is living, the Torah is adaptable. How do we live in a world of coronavirus, right? How do we do things that we can't do ordinarily? How do we make Passover, right, this year? What are we allowed to do or not allowed to do? How do we understand what we can and can't do? So the Torah is alive and is adaptable, but it's also immutable. We can't change the biblical laws. We can look at the rabbinic interpretations of the law and say there may be other opinions that were not considered major opinions or minor opinions or other ways of looking at it and adapt to that, but we can't diminish the underlying rules.
But don't you think too, like you mentioned about cooking on Shabbos and a fire. So the words, the commandment is do not light a fire on Shabbos. So don't you think that we have to use our own interpretation for, I mean, what does that mean? And why were we not supposed to light a fire? What was the, you know, so there's two aspects to that question based on whether you can ask the question to find out why you have to do it. And the other is your own interpretation of those words.
So the, you know, why, I mean? Again, it's nice to know the why.
But why? Why can't we make a fire? Why? So it doesn't matter why we can't make it. You just don't do it.
Well, again,
you have to interpret what making a fire is, whether it's turning an ignition on or a light switch, etc. Right.
Remember, when we talk about mitzvot, we usually talk. If I ask a kid, "What's a mitzvah?" If I ask a kid, even in preschool, "What's a mitzvah?" What are they going to tell me? You guys can unmute yourself if you want. What are you going to tell me? What's a mitzvah?
A good deed.
Emphasis on deed because it's an action, a good action. What is the root of the word mitzvah?
I think Tziva. The mitzvah really needs to, is really.
It means to command. It's a command.
Doing something God is proud of.
Right. It's a commandment. A mitzvah is a commandment. There are 613 biblical commandments. Those are mitzvot. A mitzvah is a commandment. A mitzvah is what we're commanded to do. A mitzvah also implies a mitzvah. That if there's a command, there's a commander, right? God is the commander, and God commands us to do a mitzvah. The reason doesn't really matter in terms of my obligation to fulfill the command. So reasons are nice, and reasons are dangerous because they'll take us away from fulfilling the command sometimes. So it's a little bit of a circular reasoning. You're right. By nature, we want to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. What we do know is living a life of meaning, of fulfilling commandments, there are commandments we understand, rational. There are commandments that are super rational we also understand. And then there are some we have no clue why God told us to do this, but it's part of what makes us, you know.
Wool and linen.
Huh?
Wool and linen.
Yeah, correct. Correct. Chatanes. What's the purpose of chatanes? No idea. Right.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
So,
that's your call.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. Great lesson.
All right. You guys have a good day, and we'll see you, some of you tonight, tomorrow. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.